I'm Michael Kist of Bleeding Green Nation, and I invite you, gentle listener, to join us for the best analysis of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles in the business. BGN Radio provides you with the most informative preview shows, and the Kist and Solak show dives deep into all the scheme and X and O details you could ever want. Plus discussions with the industry's brightest minds, including former NFL players, and press conferences from the Eagles coaching staff to keep you up to date and informed every step of the way. Subscribe to Bleeding Green Nation today. Fly, Eagles, fly.
Playing a long drive, there it is, number 500, the career 500th home run for Michael Jack Smith.
Ruiz slides, Rollins has won it, they stream out of the dugout, yeah. Rollins by yeah. Near third, this game is over.
It is out of here, 50th home run of the year for Ryan Howard.
Ruiz out to get it, the throw from his knees, it's in time, and it's a no-hitter, unbelievable, Ruiz and Helen.
Oh, Chase is going to keep going, and he's safe at home plate.
Wow.
Chase Utley, you are the man.
Swing of the miss, struck him out. The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 world champions of baseball.
Now batting for the Phillies, second baseman John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 214. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight and NumberFire.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Stolness. Coming up, we're going to talk to Eno Saris from The Athletic. Fantastic baseball writer for The Athletic. He does great stuff. He's been on Hittin' Season before. He had a piece out at the end of last week about the Phillies' offense. And we're going to talk to him about that in just a second. Try and diagnose some of the issues this team has had hitting the ball. We're going to talk about the Phillies-Mets series that just wrapped up. Hey, the Phillies won another series. Stop the presses. And, you know, they're still mathematically alive in the National League East race as they get ready for a huge four-game series down in Atlanta against the Braves. We're going to talk about that coming up in just a few minutes. Also, I want to get into here in just the next few minutes some comments made by Phillies general manager Matt Klentak. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But again, a reminder, folks, if you are not a subscriber to the Good Fight podcast feed, please go ahead and do that. If you listen to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed and you will get both episodes of Hittin' Season every week as well as a weekly episode of Continued Success that fellow Good Fighters Justin Clue and Liz Rocher do. They have a terrific episode out. I believe it's episode number 27 that just came out here on Wednesday, where they take a look back at the mid-September runs that were being made by the 93 Phillies and the 2008 Phillies. They specifically get into that very memorable series the 93 Phillies played in Montreal when the Expos were rampaging beasts and trying to track the Phillies down, when the echoes of 1964 were shouting in the background, and how the Phillies were able to manage to get through that series. Not getting swept was kind of a minor miracle, and that really was the difference in them winning that division. Also talking about the Phillies and the run that they went on that year and a couple other things. A terrific episode of Continued Success, so you'll get that, as well as Justin's podcast that he does with Dr. Trevor Strunk called The Dirty Inning, which is a fantastic podcast that looks at the worst innings in Phillies history. Also, make sure that you subscribe to the Bleeding Green Nation podcast feed. That is the Eagles podcast. I produce and host a podcast called BGN Radio, which I'm sure many of you know about. I do the preview show with Brandon Lee Gauton every Friday night. Saturday morning we record, and it's there ahead of that week's show, that week's game. So make sure you check out the Bleeding Green Nation podcast feed. And if you're a Sixers fan, go to the Liberty Ballers podcast feed. And if you're a Flyers fan, it's the Broad Street Hockey podcast feed. Make sure you're getting down on all of that. One other quick thing I'll mention real quick, and I'll talk about it a little bit more at the end of the podcast. We have a new tier for Patreon members of Hittin' Season, a $10 a month tier where we are offering a ton of really cool exclusive stuff. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season and check it out. I'll be talking a little bit more about it at the end of the podcast. I don't want to waste any more time talking about that when we could be talking about some Phillies baseball. And the Phillies, finally, had a successful series against the New York Mets. Man, It has been a struggle playing the Metropolitans this year, but the Phillies, in their final series against the Mets, actually won a series against New York. The Phillies finished the season with an 8-11 record against the Mets. Not good enough. They need to do better against the bad teams in their division, but the Phillies did manage to win 2 out of 3 in this final series at Citizens Bank Park. And it's the first time since July 25th, their first two series after the All-Star break, that the Phillies had won two series in a row. With their victory here in the finale on Wednesday, they stay within 5.5 games of the Braves in the National League East ahead of that huge 4-game series against the Braves in Atlanta starting on Thursday night. And the Phillies enter that series with a 3.9% chance of winning the division, according to Fangraphs, and a 4.4% chance of making the playoffs altogether. But don't tell that to the Phils. They still believe they have a real chance. And then, you know, numerically speaking, they do still have a chance, although it would take a miracle. It would absolutely take a miracle in order for the Phillies to track the Braves down. But we're going to get into that in just a second. First, the Phillies won the series finale 4-0 behind an outstanding effort by Zach Eflin. He had really struggled in the second half, and especially since he was sent down to AAA a few starts ago as part of roster manipulation, something that definitely rubbed him the wrong way, but he has recovered in his last two starts, really keeping the Phillies' chances alive with two huge starts against the Marlins and the Mets his last two times out. In the finale against New York, he threw 5 shutout innings with a career-high 9 strikeouts. I've criticized his lack of breaking stuff over these last few months, and I'm still not really a Zach Eflin believer, but he featured a nasty slider tonight. It really was moving all over the place. If he's going to feature that kind of a slider, I might have to change my tune a little bit. And he's given up just 1 run on 8 hits in his last 2 starts over 11 and a third innings. He had a 7.71 ERA in his 5 starts before these last two. So Eflin has gotten things going at the right time. Is it a little bit too little, too late? We will see, but it's good to see him pitch well these last two outings when the Phillies really needed him to pitch well. Rhys Hoskins hit a solo home run, his 32nd of the season in the first inning. Odubel Herrera had a Citizens Bank Park special, a moonshot 2-run homer. It was only went like 2 or 3 rows deep in right field, but that thing was a cloud scraper. Gave the Phillies a 3-0 lead off of Noah Syndergaard, who the Phillies just have had his number this year. Jose Bautista added an RBI double for the rest of the scoring in that game. Hoskins became the first player to record 2 extra base hits off of Syndergaard in a game in exactly 2 years. The last was Freddie Freeman on September 19th, 2 years to the day, as a matter of fact, back in 2016. And it's weird, but Hoskins in particular just owns Thor. He's reached base in 8 of his 13 plate appearances against Syndergaard with 2 doubles and 2 home runs. Really weird how amazing Hoskins is. There are some guys, no matter how good their stuff is, you see the ball well coming out of their hands. And for whatever reason, Hoskins seems to see the ball really well coming out of Noah Syndergaard's hands. The numbers back it up. Just one of those matchups where it just seems like it's always in Reese's favor. It was Hoskins' 11th first-inning home run this year. That is the most first-inning home runs by any player in a season since Ryan Howard hit 11 back in 2007. And Hoskins reached a milestone with that 32nd home run. It was his 50th career jack already, one of only 13 players in the last 32 years to get to 50 within his first 2 seasons in the major leagues. And just for some comparison, it took Mike Schmidt just over 1,000 plate appearances to hit 50, 1,001 plate appearances to get to that magic number. Hoskins did it in 823 plate appearances. Howard did it a little bit faster in 702 plate appearances, by the way. And his home run was historic in other ways. It's my stat of the week, so make sure you listen to the very end of the podcast to hear about the company Hoskins is keeping right now. Some other Rhys Hoskins news. He signed with super agent Scott Boras this week. Now, it always makes people a little bit nervous whenever you hear a player signing with Scott Boras, because Scott Boras clients rarely sign extensions with teams. He never gives hometown discounts. Never happens, at least not that I can ever remember. and Rhys Hoskins. Good for Rhys Hoskins. Getting an agent as good as Scott Boras. Hoskins, if he keeps this up, he is going to get paid someday, and that's what he's supposed to do. If he's still effective, hopefully it's the Phillies paying for him. It also is the same agent as his best friend, Bryce Harper. That doesn't mean anything, I don't think. I mean, Harper is going to come here or not come here based on what the Phillies offer. And if they really want Harper, they can offer him more money than anyone else. I do think it's nice that Harper and Hoskins have made this connection. And, you know, it sure seems like that certainly wouldn't hurt convincing Harper to come here if he's got a close friend on the team. But again, I don't think signing with Scott Boras means anything much as far as Rhys Hoskins is concerned. He's still under team control through the 2023 season. So the Phillies have Hoskins for a long time. They really have him locked in through his prime. By the time Hoskins is a free agent, he'll be in his early 30s, and they might not want to re-sign him at that point. We'll just have to kind of wait and see. That is really far down the road. The more interesting aspect of it is the fact that Scott Boras is a Bryce Harper client. And again, I don't really think it means anything for the Phillies to sign Bryce Harper. Now, the Phillies started Carlos Santana at third base again in the series finale against New York. It raised a lot of eyebrows when Gabe Kapler did that a couple of weeks ago, because Santana had not played third base since 2014, and even in that season, he only did it sporadically. But this is starting to happen with enough frequency that I think one would think that this is a potential solution for 2019. Santana has not looked terrible at third base. There was a play the other night where he failed to turn a double play ball, kind of doubled a grounder and failed to get a double play, and it ended up hurting the Phillies a little bit. You're going to lose something with defense at third base with Santana there. Even Michael Franco plays a better defensive third base, has a little bit more range than Santana does. He's going to cost you some runs as far as prevention is concerned, but hopefully he helps offensively. And Santana, despite the low batting average, has just about matched his career high in RBIs, has given the team, I think they would have liked to have seen a little more power from him. I really thought that Santana could hit 30 home runs in this ballpark, but I think that they would be happy to get 25 out of him. I think he'll help offensively at third base next year if they decide to keep him there. And that allows you to go out and move Rhys Hoskins to first base to play first base every day and get Bryce Harper to play the outfield or A.J. Pollock to play the outfield. And then you can still go out and get Manny Machado to play shortstop too if the Phillies decide they want to make a huge splash and spend $100 jillion and get both players. But this allows you to keep Santana, who is a useful player. I think his season this year has been more disappointing than matching expectations for me. I expected a little bit more, and maybe my expectations were a little unreasonable. But I do think Santana was really slumping for a lot of the season this year. That being said, I do think he's useful. And you'd be able to keep him without having to sell him on the cheap and eat half his salary. I think I had said a few podcasts ago that I didn't expect Carlos Santana to be back here next year, because I think it's become painfully obvious that Rhys Hoskins needs to get out of left field. But if this is a solution, that means of moving Santana to third base to get Hoskins to first, that means you're probably moving Michael Franco this offseason. And hey, Franco's trade value has never been higher. He had a very nice finish to the 2018 season. He's banged up a little bit right now, but he's still young enough that it makes him a desirable trade chip. And maybe that lets you put J.P. Crawford at shortstop, who I think has played pretty well since he was called up. He had a good defensive game here in the finale against the Mets and has come through with a few big hits. His batting stance looks a lot better. His swing looks a lot quicker. I like what I'm seeing out of J.P. Crawford there. And it seems like Kapler and the Phillies are running him out there on a regular basis right now, which I love. It's what we were calling for, and it's worked. And then I think you have Scott Kingery at second base next year. They could keep Cesar Hernandez and have Kingery be that super utility guy. I think that has messed with Kingery a little bit this year, but lots to figure out this offseason. Lots of questions there. Believe me, we're going to have the whole offseason to talk about it. But I do think Santana's ability to play third base passably gives the team some more options this winter. I think it's a real possibility that you could see that. In the second game of the series, the Phillies beat the Mets 5-2. Jorge Alfaro with a huge tie-breaking three-run home run in that game, his 10th of the season. Gabe Kapler noted before the game on Wednesday that if Alfaro ever learns to cut down on his strikeouts, he really could be a 300 hitter in this league. He could be one of the most dangerous offensive catchers in the game. It is in there. It's all in there for him, and it all has to do with plate discipline. He's got unbelievable power. When he makes contact, he smokes the ball. He kills the ball when he makes contact. He just needs to make more contact. Aaron Nola was awesome again in the middle game of the series, went 5 2/3 innings, gave up just 2 runs on 6 hits, 9 strikeouts in 5 2/3 innings with just 2 walks. He is 2/3 of an inning short of 200 innings. He will obviously get that when he goes up against the Braves in the series finale on Sunday down in Atlanta. In the first game of the series, the Mets beat the Phillies 9-4. Jake Arrieta was disappointing. 5 innings, 4 runs, 6 strikeouts, 9 hits. ERA now at 3.77 this year. I wrote a long piece for The Good Fight about Arrieta's season. Make sure you check that out. I think it has been more disappointing. The best word that you can use to describe Jake Arrieta's 2018 season is erratic. Great for some stretches, especially in May and again in July. Had a very good May and July and an adequate April. Struggled mightily in June, struggled in August, and has really struggled here in September. We're really hoping that Arrieta would go on a nice little run here in the stretch run like he did in the second half for the Cubs last season, but it just hasn't materialized, just hasn't happened. And I mentioned Crawford just a minute ago. He had a big 3-run triple in a 4-run inning that tied that game, drew the Phillies to within 4-3 and then scored on a sacrifice fly to make it 4-4. Unfortunately, Tommy Hunter surrendered the go-ahead run a couple innings later, and then Hector Neris got knocked around in the ninth for the final cushion for the Mets. But now that the Mets series is over, the Phillies get to play the team in front of them for 4 games. They get the Atlanta Braves down in Georgia. And I have a full Braves series preview that is exclusive for Patreon members of Hittin' Season. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season. That will be up by early Thursday morning. You'll get my pitching breakdowns. You'll get a look at who's been hot for the Atlanta Braves. And I'm going to break down this big series, but it's going to be for Patreon members of Hittin' Season only. So again, that's for $5 a month tier members. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season and you'll get the big Braves preview. I'll give you a brief synopsis right here. This is obviously going to be a monster series. This is obviously going to be a series in which I think the Phillies need to win all 4 games. They have to sweep Atlanta for a realistic shot at winning the division because they enter the series 5.5 back. There's a huge difference between sweeping this series and even winning 3 out of 4. Winning 3 out of 4 means you gain 2 games on the Braves and you get to 3.5 back with 7 left. A 4-game trip to Colorado against the Rockies, who are battling the Dodgers for a playoff spot in the National League West, and then another 3 games with Atlanta. This is a brutal final stretch here for the Phils. Okay, this final, 11-game stretch where you have 7 against Atlanta and then 4 against Colorado with 8 of the final 11 games all on the road, something the Phillies have not been very good at this year. Whew, they got to sweep this series because winning 3 out of 4 gets you to 3.5 back, whereas sweeping the series gets you to 1.5 back. The Phillies sweep this series, now you're talking. Now you're talking about a real chance. You're going to see those Fangraph playoff odds go way, way up. And this is really, more than anything else, I think what we're going to see in Atlanta, even if they don't pull it off, I think this is the type of learning experience that really helped the 2005 and 2006 Phillies. When they came up short, when they struggled in their final weeks of the season, when they had a real chance to win the wild card and came up short, I think those seasons helped the Phillies in 2007 and 2008. Claw and scratch their way into the postseason. It's a great learning experience. What these players are going to go through, especially this 4-game series in Atlanta, so many of these players have never been through it before. For Hoskins, for Odubel, for Cesar, for Mikel, for Nick Williams, for Alfaro, for Crawford and Kingery and Nola and Pivetta and Velasquez and Eflin and Dominguez and Neris and heck, even Gabe Kapler, who had a good series with some good pinch hit moves in this series. This is going to be a terrific learning experience, hopefully setting them up for 2019. I'm glad that the Phillies played at least well enough to win these last two series against the Marlins and the Mets for these four games in Atlanta to mean something. Because there's a reason to watch, at least the first couple of games. The Phillies lose these first two games in Atlanta, it's done, it's over. Even if they lose the first game, it's not over, but it really puts a damper in things. But if they lose the first two, it's over. As soon as the Phillies lose two games in Atlanta, it's over. So, you know, it's a matter of what can you learn in this series if you're the Phillies? If you can win all four games, it's amazing. I just don't see it happening. The Braves' magic number is down to 6. They probably have to win all 7 of their remaining games against the Atlanta Braves in order to pull this off. And I just don't know that they can do it. Listen, they got a 4% chance. They have a 4% chance of doing it. That tells you all you need to know. The Braves are heavy, heavy, heavy favorites. A magic number of 6 is minuscule. The Braves are probably going to win this division, but the Phillies have a chance. As Gabe Kapler said last week, they have a chip in a chair. They're still in this thing. They still believe they're going to play every game like it's the last game. And so we'll watch and we'll see that this is going to be a good learning experience for the Phillies, I think. To be able to go through this process, I think, is going to be really good for this team. So, again, the Phillies wrap up a series win against the Mets, and for the first time in what feels like months, head to Atlanta, head to their next series with actual real-life momentum.
This ball is out of here!
Well, it's a question we've all been asking ourselves since the start of the baseball season. What has happened to the Phillies' bats this year? What is going on with the offense? And we really haven't gotten a whole lot of answers. We see a lot of the numbers, and we know that it hasn't been good, but we can't figure out what happened between the end of last year and this year. The Phillies' offense just not performing. And joining me to talk about a piece that he wrote for The Athletic late last week, titled What Has Happened to the Phillies' Bats This Year, a perfect title for what we've all been angsting about, is Eno Saris from The Athletic. You can follow Eno on Twitter, at Eno Saris. Eno, thanks for coming back on Hittin' Season. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I really wanted to get you on to talk about this piece because I think it illuminated the problems that the Phillies offense has had this year, put it into real clear perspective. And, you know, I don't know what the solutions are, but we're going to try and nail that down maybe in just a little bit. But first, you know, it's as we've watched this team, as Phillies fans, as we've watched this offense struggle, there's some good names in this lineup. There are some names that I think we all thought would be better. They made some additions at the trade deadline that we thought would make them better. And coming off of the second half last year, when they had a weighted on base average in the second half as a team that was 13th in baseball, they were 10th in runs scored in the second half last year. Their OPS was 13th. Their average was 11th. Their on base percentage was 12th. This is all top half of baseball. We kind of thought, okay, there's going to be a little bit of improvement. This year, the weighted on base average is 21st. They're 21st in runs scored, 21st in OPS, 27th in average, 18th in on base percentage. And in your piece, you talk about the fact that the Phillies did not meet the projections that Fangraphs had for them. How far off were the projections for the Phillies?
Well, right now, only two teams are falling more short of their projected runs scored per game. So the Mariners were, are supposed to score 4.5 runs per game, and they're scoring 4.1. The Orioles, I think, probably the projections are struggling to catch up with how that team has been decimated and the personnel changes on that team. That was changing day to day at the time that I checked this. But the Phillies have had a much more regular lineup. I mean, they've sort of settled on 9 players they play regularly, and of those 9 players, 7 are homegrown, and have had, you know, 6 of them have some track record in the major league. So, it is weird that they are falling so far short of their projections. And then I also looked, you know, under the hood, and they've gotten worse at hitting the ball well.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, you know, putting the right angles and launch angles. The players that were on the team last year are just worse at doing the same things they were doing last year.
Yeah, and you look at the numbers, according to Fangraphs, they're last in baseball in hard hit percentage, third to last in line drive rate. One of the things that I've always noticed with this team this year is that they really struggle in hitters' counts. On 3-1 counts, they're hitting .314, which sounds great, but that's actually second lowest in baseball because everybody's supposed to be able to hit when you're ahead in the count 3-1. Is luck factoring into this at all? Or are they an unlucky team?
Well, given their launch angles and exit velocities, no. They are not unlucky. They're, in fact, in the bottom third of unluckiest teams. However, if you asked me, if you sort of set this up for me and you said, okay, I've got a team here, they're in the top five, they're in the top three of the NL when it comes to strikeout rate, they're in the top three in the NL in terms of lifting the ball. So in terms of walk rate, in terms of lifting the ball, I'm like, okay, you've got a patient team mm-hmm. that puts the ball in the air. They've got a park that's going to reward putting the ball in the air. I think you've probably got a good offense. But that's not the case. They strike out more than anybody else in the NL, save one team, and they just haven't shown the power. So despite what looks like a good approach in terms of, you know, walking and putting the ball in the air, they're not hitting for power. So, you know, maybe it is just a few misses when it comes to those balls on, you know, in hitters' counts. But, you know, by this time, over the course of a season, and with a team that's largely homegrown, you start to ask questions about the process of developing these guys as hitters, what's changed at the major league level from last year to this year, and if this is something has been a longer time coming, as in, you know, all the way up.
Well, you mentioned in your piece, and we talked about it on this podcast a little bit last week, the fact that they have dismissed a few of their minor league hitting instructors. And I know that at the major league level, fans have been wondering about the approach because they have a new hitting coach this year. John Mailey and Pedro Guerrero Jr. are the two guys who are really shepherding these young offensive players here in this season, and it does appear that there has been some regression. And then we know this is a team that has trouble stringing together hits. They want to go walk, home run. That's kind of the offense that they've designed. And outside of Rhys Hoskins, who has cleared 30 home runs, there really isn't a power hitter on this team. So the question we've been asking ourselves, and I don't know if the numbers bear this out one way or the other, is whether or not this is an approach problem. Is it a talent problem? Is it a coaching problem? Or is it just really kind of impossible to tell right now?
Yes. And this is where we're going to venture. We're going to venture a little bit into opinion. I've been trying to base most of what I'm saying in numbers.
Okay.
I'm going to venture out a little bit and try to put something together here because, you know, you can't always nail this stuff down.
No.
The effect of a coach is difficult enough. But one thing that we've found in the past is the effect of a hitting coach, the strongest part of that effect is on whether or not the hitters are aggressive or if they're more patient. So let's say that's the strongest effect that a hitting coach can have.
Okay.
So what I think there might be just a poor interaction between the players they developed, and it might just be this random group of players, these players in particular. It may not be about the development. It may just be these players that they have. I think there might just be not a great interaction between their normal skills, their best talents, and what John Mailey brings to the table. Because I think John Mailey, you know, I guess Gabe Kapler came out and sort of tried to refute my piece a little bit. And he came out and he gave a little speech before the game after mm-hmm. the day after my piece came out. And he said, you know, John Mailey gives them, you know, great sense of what they should be swinging at and be aggressive at, the places they're best at, and then the places they're not so good at, they should be more passive. And we interact with our players all the time, and they know this. So I hear that. And my personal reaction to John Mailey is that I think that he's really smart, and I think he's using all of the best available research to coach hitters. So I don't think that John Mailey's bad at his job.
Yeah.
I just think that if you think about some of their guys, Nick Williams, Cesar Hernandez, Odubel Herrera, and you think about their sort of interaction with patience and aggressiveness,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that any of them are like amazing at discerning being patient.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Odubel tried it for a month, right?
Remember right.
That time? Like,
yeah.
I'm just going to walk all the time.
I'm going to bat flip walks, and I'm going to have a good time doing it, and that didn't last more than April. You're right.
Cesar is a little bit better, but he's also not an aggressive, he's not a power hitter. And I think this year he's improved his launch angle. If you want to hit for power, he's hitting more fly balls. But I think we're seeing that he's not necessarily a power hitter. So it's not, I don't think it's done, it's been great for him to do that.
Yeah.
Maybe Nick Williams is a little bit more like Odubel and needs to just be, maybe he needs to swing too much. You know,
yeah.
Maybe you need to get him in swing mode, and he's be more aggressive, and maybe he's going to be aggressive in the parts where he's, you know, he shouldn't be aggressive sometimes. But maybe that means you really finally unlock 35 homers out of it,
like Javi Baez
walk rate.
Yeah, I mean, it's
yeah. So I think there are just matches between hitting coaches and players, and it's really hard to figure it out. That's why I think teams cycle through hitting coaches a lot. I don't necessarily blame any one person for this, but I think it does look like there's a weird interaction going on right now where there's a lot of stagnation from these hitters, and they haven't really taken a step forward.
And I guess, you know, there's a delicate balance between a coaching staff and an organizational philosophy and the players that you have, between putting a system in place, putting a philosophy in place that we want to take more pitches, we want to be this kind of a team, and what a player is naturally able to do, what a player may naturally be good at. You know, mm-hmm. We saw Aaron Altair last year look like he was going to be, if healthy, a very good major league player, and he really just, he got off to a 3-month start where he could not get it together and spent most of the year in AAA as a result. Is that because they asked him to, and I'm not asking you, I'm just saying, you know, is it because they asked him to change his approach, and did that mess him up? And that's the question we've all been asking ourselves here with a lot of these different players, is changing an approach, has that messed them up a little bit? You know, I mean, should the organization obviously have a philosophy, but also understand that some of their players might fit outside that philosophy and kind of go with it? I don't know how you find that middle ground.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Altair and Cesar Hernandez, in a way, they both had something that was kind of working and then did kind of change their approach, and both have seen their walks increase, but also their strikeouts, to the point for Altair where it's, you know, it's getting close to, you know, unplayable. I mean, 33% works if you're going to hit, 35 homers.
Yeah.
But not if you're going to hit 15. So, and Cesar Hernandez, it's still working. He's been good. I'm not saying he's been bad. But, you know, he was better last year, and he was better last year with more ground balls and a slightly more aggressive approach. So, I don't think that necessarily changing Maley is going to solve it. But if Maley, you know, talks to his hitters and says, you know, hey, how do you feel about this year, and what would you like to do next year? And I think that's what good coaches do. I mean, they're there to help, but they don't need to necessarily put their worldview on everyone. Because, you know, one of my favorite hitting coaches is Dave Hudgens over the Astros, and when I talk to him about different hitters, he's always talking about, he talks about something different each time. You know, he talks mm-hmm. about, mechanics with one hitter, or he'll talk about approach with another. And so I think that that's the sort of flexibility that I hope that Maley will show in this offseason when he kind of gathers back up again and looks. I mean, it's not without, there was one improver, and it's actually kind of amazing, because I've been a Michael Franco stan for a long time.
You have been, yeah.
This guy hits the ball hard, he'll figure it out, and, you know, I'm a little underwhelmed that this is figuring it out. It's like 4 or 5% better than league average. It's not the most amazing thing, but hey, he kind of has, and his is an aggressive approach. You know, he doesn't walk, but he doesn't strike out. He's going to hit, you know, 20, well, he may be done for the season with the injuries, huh?
Yeah, it looks like he's really struggling to kind of get back out there. He's played a couple times, but I think they'd be wise to just shut him down, yeah.
It's still a minor victory.
I mean, it is.
It's still a chance that he's a league average player, and maybe there's one more step with the power next year, and he can be kind of like a 275 hitter with like 25 to 30 homers. That seems much more possible this year than last year. So, you know, it's not like they lost on every front. And Rhys Hoskins, he had a little bit of a bump in the road, but he's been great. So there's still some building blocks here. And, you know, with Nick Williams, the season as a whole, I think, has to be counted as, maybe a step backwards, but it's not like he's not going to be useful going forward. So, there's still a lot of pieces here. And I think that's also why people get so frustrated. It's like, what? I thought we had something going here. I thought that's why we were buying starters.
And, yeah.
You know, and I thought we had a lineup in place. So,
yeah. Well, you mentioned in your piece, what I thought may have been the most worrisome thing is that, you know, it really doesn't seem as though these hitters know the strike zone as well as they need to, because, you know, we see that they take a lot of pitches. They make pitchers work. They get pitchers out after five innings. They're very good at doing that. But they don't seem to be able to make pitchers pay for all of those, for piling up pitches. You know, they work counts, but they don't do much when they get a fastball in a fastball count. They tend to chase pitches out of the strike zone also, and let too many pitches maybe early in counts go by. And these are, you know that sometimes you may get just one pitch to hit in a plate appearance. And so I wonder if any of this is because there are so many first and second year guys here, whether this is just a year where they're gaining experience and they'll get better next year because they have another year under their belt, or whether it's just this is their talent level. This is what they are. And that's what I think is the most frustrating for Phillies fans right now is, we don't know the answers to those questions, and I was hoping we would get some answers to those questions.
Well, the studying baseball is much more about questions than about answers. I would say that the fact that they're so short of their projections, I would count that as a good sign. That's saying that the underlying numbers, the track records that are there, they imply that they should be doing better. So I would say that. That goes to the theory that this is a step back. Also, I think, you know, it's kind of hard to do this as a fan, but as a more of an analyst, I thought going into the season, I thought, you know what, they're close. I'm not sure they're there. I'm going to say that I think they're closer than a lot of people think before the season.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, they're still one of the youngest teams in baseball.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially on the lineup side. So, you know, I did a correlation once where I tried to do a correlation between age and winning percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found, that what was really surprising me, was that age and winning percentage were positively correlated. And I think that just means because the oldest lineups are 30, and the youngest are like 26. So there's not a lot of separation in there, and it's not. It's not a big F finding that I can go take to a team or whatever. What I think what's actually going on there is that there is too young.
Mm-hmm.
That the very young teams are usually casting about and trying to find players. Like even finding Aaron Altherr, some of that was just sort of, well, he might be good and we're bad and let's put him out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And see what we've got. And that's Odubel Herrera. That's why they have Odubel Herrera. Rule 5, just send them out there and see what we got.
Right.
There is a too young, and as teams sort of gel, what they do is they find out, okay, of these sort of failures that we've had, which is the one that is going to bounce back? Which ones are the productions happy about? Is Scott Kingery our utility man next year, and we go sign Manny Machado? Is that sort of the big deal? That we can that'll have sort of repercussions for the whole lineup, and I think it could be. You put Manny there. You got Manny, Rhys, and Cesar kind of goes back to being a table setter, and Carlos just walks and hits homers. All of a sudden, you're kind of like, okay, now we have. And Michael Franco comes back. Now you got a more legitimate 1-5 again. So, they have a lot of money to spend. These players are supposed to be better, and they're young. I think these are all the silver lining here in what kind of looks pretty cloudy right now.
Yeah, I mean, the Phillies don't really have a Ronald Acuna or an Ozzie Albies or even a Freddie Freeman or a Juan Soto right now, but...
Well, okay.
I guess maybe Freddie Hoskins?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. I'm more saying that because, you know, the Phillies are probably going to have the money to go out and buy those guys, you know, like
right.
Machado or yeah. Harper or whoever it is they want to go out and get this offseason. That's how they're going to get their guys, probably.
Yeah. And I could see, and they're actually in a sort of flexible place with having a bunch of guys that are okay. They can move them around a little bit. I think that Machado fits the team a little bit better.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And I think it kind of fits right in there in the middle, and it gives them, you know, one of the biggest failures has been power. I think Manny comes in and gives them that power right in the middle of the lineup, and they can have guys that can table set around it, and they can mix and match. And if Aaron Altherr doesn't, you know, regain what he found, they can move on to other outfielders in the system. So, you know, I think that would be a huge deal for Phillies this offseason if they get Manny.
Well, it is going to be a really interesting offseason because they've got a lot of players on this roster. They're going to have some moves. They're going to have to move. If they want to bring in free agents, they're going to have to move some guys out of here and find other homes for them. It'll be interesting to see what kind of decisions they make defensively. That'll impact the offense that they're able to put on the field every week. But this piece, you know, was fantastic. I read it like two or three times because it's got a lot of good stuff in there. Go to Eno's Twitter timeline if you haven't read it yet, at Eno Saris from The Athletic. It's a terrific piece. Eno, thank you so much for coming back on Hit and Season. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. And you know, I think it's important to remember as the season ends like this that, you know, it's going to leave a bad taste in the mouth. But there were so many awesome things that happened. I mean, Aaron Nola is really like the ace we thought he was. You know, Rhys Hoskins figured it back out. Michael Franco took a huge step forward. The pitching staff in general was something to be proud of. And if they do sign a couple bats and turn some of their internal bats, move them around to get something else, they can probably restock the pitching staff a little bit while signing a bat. It could be a really productive offseason for them.
Oh, man, from your lips to God's ears, that's what we're all hoping for, man. Thanks again, Eno. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
This ball is out of here!
Well, I wanted to mention a few comments by General Manager Matt Klentak before we finished up the podcast this week. He spoke to reporters, I think it was over the weekend, talking about the state of the team and some of the things that have happened over these last few weeks. He talked about the fact that analytics aren't going to go away as long as he's here. Now, he's heard the criticisms of Gabe Kapler and the lineups and the way the team has been using analytics. And he said, when I was brought in here 3 years ago, I wasn't brought in here to do things the way they'd always been done. You guys remember that there was a narrative surrounding the Phillies that they were slow to adjust. So that is our job, to move the needle, to stay current and win baseball games. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. I think it's fair to question, have they utilized the information correctly? Have they used defensive shifting information correctly? Have they been using this information but also tempering it with a little bit of common sense? You can't, like we've talked about on this podcast, especially the Hit and Seasons with Justin and Liz, you can't manage just by numbers alone. There has to be some feel. There has to be some gut instinct. There has to be, you know, these games are played by human beings. And by moving them around, by having them do all kinds of crazy things, that can sometimes affect the way a player plays. Nevertheless, the Phillies are going by numbers. The fact remains, you get these numbers through previous results. You're making decisions based on what's happened in the past because the past is the best predictor that you have sometimes. And so we don't want the Phillies to go back into the dark ages where they were with Ruben Amaro Jr., where they thought that RBIs meant more than walks as far as production is concerned. I think we've learned this year as Phillies fans that analytics are important, the numbers are important. You do not want to be behind the curve in Major League Baseball when it comes to that stuff, but there needs to be a balance between all of these different things, and I think Klentak knows that, and I think that's what he's talking about. He did note that this was a good year to kind of experiment with some things. He said, quote, candidly, this was an excellent season to try new things with a young roster and with relatively modest expectations, and we did. Some of them worked, and we'll continue to use them. Some of them didn't, and we won't use them anymore. but we'll continue pressing forward because that is our job. Kind of curious which are some of the ones that he doesn't think worked and won't use them anymore. I would have loved to have known a little bit more about that, but obviously those are trade secrets, people. He's going to keep those close to the vest. And so much of the information that the team uses on a daily basis is stuff that we do not have access to. It's stuff that's internal. Their proprietary computer system, Phil, is feeding this stuff out. And their analytics guys are doing really hard work to get the numbers out. And it's a learning process. Again, he's right. This is probably the best season to try some different things out. I noticed the Phillies have not tried the opener yet, and I am praying to God they never, ever do use the opener, because I think we're seeing it work with the Tampa Bay Rays a little bit. I just find it distasteful, and I don't like it. And that's one of the reasons why I think they haven't used it yet. I think Gabe Kapler admitted as much, that it wouldn't go over very well in Philadelphia. I can tell you for sure that it would not. The Phillies, a lot of new players in the locker room thanks to some trades at the deadline, and he was asked whether that negatively affected the team chemistry and the play on the field. He said, quote, "We have theories about different things that may have contributed. It's probably some kind of combination of a lot of things. I will not sit here and tell you that the chemistry changed in such a way that that is the reason we struggled. I don't believe that." I don't really believe that either. I think the chemistry may have played a part. I think you've heard players talk about the locker room has been different. We heard Megan Montemuro talk about that on the podcast last week. The vibe in the locker room is different when you introduce some veteran players who have never been there before. It definitely has some kind of an effect. Is that the reason that the pitching staff went south? Is that the reason that the offense couldn't hit? Probably not. I think, you know, when you're introducing all these new players into the lineup and some guys lose playing time, that can have an effect. But most of the guys who lost playing time, like Scott Kingery, weren't really doing all that well to begin with. So it's fair to wonder whether or not it actually had anything to do. But it certainly is not something that Klintak is dismissing out of hand. He seemed to acknowledge that he was unsure just how true a contender the team was at the trade deadline, and that unsureness affected how he went about things at the deadline. He said, quote, "And candidly, we thought about that as we thought about that," that meaning that he was unsure how true a contender they were. "We thought about that as we were making trade deadline decisions in July. How aggressive should we be? Is this real? And the reality was we were getting great starting pitching, a very solid and deep bullpen, and we were in first place. And how can we not go for it? How can we not make moves? We felt really bullish about that decision to add Wilson Ramos, Ezdrubal Cabrera, Aaron Loop, and to double down on that in the month of August with three more additions." I think, you know, and I'm not going to criticize Matt Klintak for the additions that he made. I think bringing in Ezdrubal Cabrera was the right move at the time. We forget how brutal Scott Kingery was at the plate. He was killing this team. Wilson Ramos has been outstanding behind the plate, to the point where, as bullish as I am on Jorge Alfaro, I would like to see the Phillies re-sign Wilson Ramos for another year or two. Aaron Loop was a disaster. He's just been useless, and that was a non-signing. And I think the Phillies really did miss an opportunity to either sign, trade for a starting pitcher or trade for a closer, a relief pitcher, to help out with the bullpen that imploded numerous times during the second half and cost the Phillies dearly in some big, big, big ways. They might be in a really good position to make the postseason right now had Klintak gone on and gotten some more pitching help and not relied on these pitchers to do what they're doing. I didn't understand the addition of Jose Bautista. I still don't. I think it would have been, it's fine as a bench move, and that's kind of how they're using him now. I don't like him in the field late in games, and I don't like him starting. I just don't like it. Unless there's a particular pitcher he has wailed recently, I'm not for it. And Justin Bour has been up and down. He's had some good moments, but, you know, Justin Bour has great numbers against Atlanta Braves pitching. I think we're going to see him a lot in the Atlanta series. Klintak was also asked about the talent level on the 25-man roster. And this is a question we've all been asking ourselves. Just how talented is this 25-man roster? And Klintak said, quote, "I think we're still developing in that department. look, we're in the latter half of September and we're still playing meaningful baseball games. Through the rebuild, we've now gotten ourselves to a point where we're relevant again. We were in first place for a good portion of the year. We're playing games on national television again. People are talking about the Phillies. We have marketable players. There's a lot of good that's come. Rosters will continue to evolve. We will continue to get better, whether that's through players in our system, the development of guys who are on this field already, trades that we might make in the future, free agents that we might bring in the future, just general happenings in baseball operations. The roster will continue to evolve and get more talented as we go. Right now, we're in a position where our roster is talented enough to play meaningful games in September, and that's an important first step to where we were a year ago. And that brings us basically back to square one. That's what this season was supposed to be about, was getting this team ready to make the leap in 2019. And the struggles of these last few weeks have certainly made the ending of this 2018 season feel worse than it probably actually is. The Phillies go on a little run here at the end. It's going to make us all feel a little bit better about it. But we all have a lot of uncertainty in what we all are very uncertain, is what is how I will put it, about who is worth keeping on this 25-man roster. Who is a part of this team's long-term future? Who isn't? What answers did we get this offseason? Everybody's got their own opinions. We've talked about it a lot on this podcast. Not enough time to dig into every one of these players. Again, as we enter the offseason, we're going to get into all of those different things, trying to figure out who on this 25-man roster is worth keeping and worth moving. And again, a lot of it is going to be about which of these guys are valuable in trades to add significant pieces to the roster next year. It might be the Phillies have guys they would like to keep, but find that they're more valuable as trade chips. Or find that some of the guys they like may not have any trade value and have to keep them. It's just part of the work Matt Klintak and the front office is going to have to do coming up here this offseason.
This ball is out of here!
And now it's time for your stat of the week. Rhys Hoskins, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, hit his 50th home run of his career. It was in his 192nd game. That is the seventh fastest any player has ever gotten to 50 home runs in terms of games. Rudy York is the fastest all-time to 50 home runs. Took him just 153 games to get there. Mark McGwire was second with 161, tied with Gary Sanchez, also at 161. Ryan Braun got to 50 home runs in 171 games. Aaron Judge did it in 174. And Ryan Howard did it in 182. Rhys Hoskins, the seventh fastest to hit 50 home runs in his 192nd career game. One other Rhys Hoskins note, he also hit a double in the finale against the Mets. He now has 35 doubles and 32 homers this year. The only players in the majors with as many doubles and home runs are J.D. Martinez, Francisco Lindor, Jose Ramirez, Javier Baez, Matt Carpenter, and Trevor Story. By the way, those guys are all MVP candidates. One other thing before we get out of here this week, I did mention earlier in the podcast that we have beefed up the Patreon, and we have indeed. I want you guys to make sure you check out patreon.com/hittinseason, because once you get to patreon.com/hittinseason, you're going to notice a brand new tier there that I want you guys to take advantage of if you are so desiring to do so. With the $10 a month tier, you'll continue to get all of the different podcasts that we have been providing already. Some of the bonus Hit and Season stuff, the series previews. We're going to be doing some other things during the off season. You've had the Dirty Inning Hit and Run podcast as well. And whenever I do some exclusive interviews, I've got an exclusive interview with Phil's minor league pitcher Zach Warren. That's going to be for Patreon members only. That's going to be added on Thursday night or Friday morning, as well as the Phillies Braves preview will be added on Thursday morning. But with this new $10 a month tier, you will receive a weekly Monday Phillies Major League Baseball newsletter from me. It'll feature a featured piece that you won't see anywhere else. It'll have news and notes and stats and opinion, and it'll also give you some links for any stories you may have missed around the majors and around the Phillies. I hope it's a newsletter you guys are really going to enjoy. Also, you'll get some other exclusive access to feature stories written by us. We want to start to introduce a little bit more written content for the Patreon listeners as a thank you for being $10 a month tier members of Hittin' Season. Also, you'll get priority position for mailbag questions. that when we do mailbag Q&As, we got one of those coming up here pretty soon. You'll have an opportunity to send in topics for off-season continued success podcasts and an opportunity to send in innings for the Dirty Inning and the Dirty Inning Hit and Run podcast. You will also be able to listen to a new version of Continued Success that we call Continued Success After Dark, in which Justin, Liz, and possibly a guest will do a little drinking probably and discuss the Phillies and baseball, pop culture, anything else. It's going to be a really loose show. Really, it's no holds barred. Anything goes. Very different from Hittin' Season and the Continued Success you already know. You'll get that podcast, and you'll be entered into a 2 to 3 times yearly drawing to be a guest on that podcast so that you can join us to talk about the Phillies and about baseball and all that kind of stuff. That way, a way for you to interact with us on Hittin' Season and on Continued Success. Again, that's by becoming a $10 a month tier member. You'll also get invitations to possible future meet and greets with me, Justin, and Liz. We're working on some possibilities for next year, so we can get together and meet some of you guys. And you'll also get early notification about possible future Hittin' Season events and live podcasts. Again, all that stuff is in the works, but that is if you join the $10 tier of the Hittin' Season Patreon. Again, go to patreon.com/hittin'season. That'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Eno Saras for coming on the podcast this week. If you haven't done so, gang, please subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed by going to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcast, subscribe. And please, ratings and reviews, if you haven't done so and you would like to help me out, please leave a review. Let me know what you think of the show. Give the show a 5-star rating if you like it. You have no idea how much that helps the podcast when you do that, if you haven't already. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.
Hey everybody, how you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all Flyers, all the time show, so much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team, the Flyers.